I like the line, hold them cheap, may who ne'er hung there.
Yeah.
How easy it is for people who haven't experienced the real darkness to pass over it and say, it's all in your mind or something. But then how anyone who has hung there understands exactly.
Yeah.
When does the cliffs of fall? It's left out.
Cliffs of fall frightful, I think it is, isn't it?
Cliffs of loneliness?
You could say cliffs of frightful falling possibilities or something like that. Cliffs of fall, it's the right kind of sound at the end of the line. I think that's one reason it's there. It's an apocalyptic image, too. The possibility of complete disaster. Victorian poetry and literature is full of apocalyptic imagery of crumbling cliffs. The ground is being pulled out from under us. We are falling over the edge. It's kind of an undertone in all Victorian literature that Hopkins contributes to.
The whole world groans in travail.
Yeah.
And that's his name.
Collapse. It's going to collapse. Let's read the other one, too, at the top. I wake and feel the fell of dark. And there's another one I'd like to read you as well. That's not on the sheet. Okay, this is after he wakes up. Now let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. And then I'd like to ask you, too, how those of you who are here yesterday, one, two of us, how you think these are different from the nature sonnets that he wrote earlier. Besides not being so optimistic. I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh what black hours we have spent this night. What sights you, heart, saw, ways you went, and more must in yet longer light's delay. With witness I speak this, but where I say hours, I mean years, I mean life, and my lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him that lives, alas, away. I am gall, I am heartburn. God's most deep decree bitter would have me taste. My taste was me. Bones built in me, flesh filled, blood brimmed the curse. Self yeast of spirit, a dull dough sours. I see the lost are like this, and their scourge to be as I am mine, their sweating selves, but worse.
Seems one of the ways that these are different than his nature poems are that these are all incurvatus and say, they're all turned in on himself.
Yes.
And not, it's as though there is the connection between himself and nature has been cut off. He can't see past the darkness of his own mind and night dreams that seem to have no end. Nothing breaks into it either. And self-yeast of spirit, he knows it makes a sour dough, and yet what other kind of yeast? I mean, where is the spirit there, which would be the yeast at another point?
Mm-hmm.
And who's the scourge? But he has to be the scourge himself. So it's a real self-contained thing.
Yeah. There's a poem we did yesterday called Hurrahing in Harvest, in which Hopkins, a poet, speaker, is so excited about the beauty of nature and the God that he sees in it that he throws his cap in the air and leaps off the ground. This is a completely opposite movement. It's a movement inward. And instead of addressing his heart and addressing nature, kind of in a celebration of his harmony with it, he's addressing himself in the dark night of his soul, and that's all. He has a concept called instress, which we talked about too, that has to do with the force of being that holds everything together. And here you feel that whatever holds together is stifling. It's like being trapped in some sour dough. You know, what an awful image that is. And also a very homely image, the kind that he frequently used for himself. I don't know, other people have some things to say about this poem.
So his inscape in himself has become a prison, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, he celebrates the selving of things. He thinks that the individual particularity of everything is its perfection and celebrates God's beauty just in that, in being itself, in being yourself, or in a tree being itself. Here, selving becomes an occasion for despair and blankness. Yeah. I am gall, I am heartburn. He probably did have heartburn. He's not using these words lightly. You can think of this next time you see a commercial on television. Alka-Seltzer.
What's the poem where he is wrestling at night and then the last line is, my God, my God?
Yeah, that's another one I see. Carry and comfort.
Carry and comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When he's at the end, there is, we talked the other day about how it gets real black in his poems and then gets a little brown, like the dawn is beginning to come up. I think that happens at the end of the poem, very little bit. He says, but worse. I mean, a man who is going through this kind of despair can't help but wonder if he is lost, if his soul is lost. He says, though I can see the lost are like this. There's an immense empathy he feels for other people, and particularly the lost in this experience. That they are doomed, or their scourge is to be their sweating selves. They're just trapped within themselves, as he is. But worse, but their situation is worse. He only gives it two words, that's all. That kind of lifting up. But they're worse. And, you know, there are some people who don't think that's really sincere, that this is just, you know, that he doesn't really feel that. You barely feel it in the poem, I think. I'm drawing back from that black vision. I don't know. What do you think about that? Does it draw back for you when you read it in the last two words? Or does that seem tacked on somehow?
Well, he has his poetry. I mean, it's almost like that is, you know, some sort of vent with other people that are going through that don't even have that.
He doesn't say that here, but it's true. He does have his poetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's with witness, I speak this? That his heart witnesses it, or he uses we, and he's speaking to his heart.
Well, I'm not sure what exactly he's talking about witnessing to. He's witnessing to his own pain, but possibly also to the withdrawal of God's grace. Light is delaying. The light of grace is delaying for him.
So it's not as though someone else is witnessing what he is speaking. As God is my witness, or I speak this, or that's not what he's saying.
No, God, I don't think it's God it's himself that's his witness, I think. I don't think he's saying, suggesting there's any other person. Yeah. My lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him that lives, alas, away. Him is Christ, I assume. He doesn't capitalize what we discovered yesterday, so he doesn't give us that clue. In a line, I'm gall, I am heartburn. God's most deep decree would have me taste bitterness. You know, he's saying that my taste was me. He's talking about the taste of sin, I think. And perhaps his own peculiar kinds of sin, whatever he thought that was. But in another version of this poem, he had said, God's most just decree. He took that out, put the word deep in instead. Now, why do you think he did that? He didn't explain it. But he had probably a good reason for it, or it felt right for some reason. What would just have done to that line, you think?
In both these poems, I'm sure there's something we should remember. Who's the prophet in the Old Testament who always was angry at God because God has unjustly scourged him and plighted him with all these things?
Job.
This is what this reminded me of. In a way, both same with this first one. Uh-huh. It almost seems, and I like it because it seems this way, that he has been... He's going through this pain, and it's God's fault in a way. Why aren't you there when I need you? Why haven't... It's not my fault at this time. I need you, and I've called you, and you haven't answered.
Yeah.
And I'm mad. I had a feeling that when he said God's most deep decree, it's almost as if God's doing this to me. I don't understand why.
Mm-hmm. And if he had said just.
Yeah, if it was just, it would have been as if I placed the fault on myself.
Yeah. Deep can also mean something kind of devious or, you know, mysteriously unfair, and it doesn't give a moral judgment.
Or it could mean something even more profound than simply a moral judgment.
Yeah.
It goes far beyond what just mere justice would.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of unfathomable. Unfathomable. No man fathomed, maybe, as in the other poem.
And since it's followed by bitter, sometimes you have to go into something to find the bitterest part of it. You know, you go deep into it.
Yeah.
And that could be that. And also just having the word deep instead of just in the line, deep decree, kind of, they fit together, the two words, just kind of reinforce certain sounds at the end of the line, which may be random and may have just happened, but I think they work well.
Yeah.
Reinforcing the sound at the end moves you to me in the next line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the rhymes are significant, usually. There's a connection between the decree and me, but he's not quite sure what it is.
Well, that's maybe where...
I think that the deep is part of the me. That's why it's deep, because it's something to do with it.
In the first stanza, he talks about this night where the heart looks, and it seems to me that it is looking deeper and deeper into himself. He's somehow being confronted with his being, which is so bitter and so repulsive to himself. And what amazes me, I guess, is that that he adds the but worse, that in all of that awful self-knowledge or whatever that is tormenting him, or seeing himself so clearly, or his self and me comes up again and again. His narcissism, maybe he's almost in despair about his own despair.
Yeah.
That's what he's feeling, maybe instead of the joy of his earlier sonnets or that that has lost him. And I think of Hemingway and his short story Nada. That just echoes again and again. And that kind of existential despair of saying, there is nothing. That deep internal journey of nothing. But here, it's but worse.
You can see how he anticipates so much of modern literature in these sonnets. I mean, there are other works of this period in England that belong to that same kind of late century pessimism that recurs in century after century, and I think it's coming over us again in the 20th century. Joseph Conrad's novel, Heart of Darkness, belongs to this period. There's also a wonderful poem by James Thompson called The City of Dreadful Night that belongs to this period. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is another kind of work. With kind of mysterious, something is mysteriously wrong in the nature of things. And the idea of entropy, which was introduced formally, I think, in the 1850s, is becoming more scientifically disseminated. That you have everything running down and running out. Our night whelms, and will end us, that sense, too. So it's a cultural feeling of decadence, decay, things falling apart, as well as a personal despair of the soul. And it's a period piece in some ways. And Hopkins, having to lead to some extent a public life, was well aware of that, particularly when he was in Ireland. Would you like me to read the Carry and Comfort one? I wish it were on the sheets. We just couldn't make any more than a one sheet size, and my typewriter was only so tiny. But this is just a really powerful poem. It has the second most obscure line in his poetry, and you'll hear it. And I want you to feel it and not worry too much about the syntax. We can straighten it out later if we want to. No, I'll not carry in comfort, despair, not feast on thee, not untwist, slack they may be, these last strands of man in me, or most weary, cry, I can no more. I can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be. But thou terrible, why wouldst thou rude on me thy ring-world right foot rock? Lay a lion limb against me, scan with darksome devouring eyes my bruised bones, and fan, in turns of tempest, me heat there, me frantic to avoid thee and flee. Why, that my chaff might fly, my grain lie sheer and clear? Nay, in all that toil, that coil, since seems I kissed the rod, hand rather, my heart, lo, sapped, lapped strength, stole joy, would laugh, cheer, Cheer whom, though? The hero whose heaven-handling flung me, foot-trod me? Or me that fought him? Oh, which one? Is it each one? That night, that year of now-done darkness, I, wretch, lay wrestling with, my God, my God. Would you like to explicate this poem, Susan?
I just think that's just the best of this.
Yeah. God is a monster coming to him.
You can't help but think of the Jacob, of Jacob wrestling and going away limping and bruised like we do whenever we're that intimate with anything. We always get hurt.
Yeah.
But then saying, you know, don't leave until you bless me. And there is a blessing in there too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There is a,
mm-hmm.
Because the second my God is, like you read it, is the sign of recognition.
Recognition, yeah. So it too is an epiphany poem,
oh, yeah.
Moving toward the revelation of a divine presence who has been encountered as a monster in the night. These poems kind of make your spiritual life feel so thin and ordinary, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like this, but never this way, in this kind of vivid, intense way. I suppose if we feel this kind of mood coming on, we run off real quickly, or we distract ourselves. Or as Eliot says in one of his poems, we are distracted by distraction from distraction. You would say something. No, you would say something.
We get such a jaundiced view of Christ through the Gospels. If he'd written himself and, you know, left his friends directly behind, I think they would have been much more taking the same sort of course that happens to his poems. Through the initial high, the exaltation, through the, just the cavalry, the bombing, and then into the resurrection.
Yeah, there's such a strong tendency to domesticate the Gospels and to make them familiar and comfortable and make you feel good and stuff. And it starts in Sunday school and it just keeps on going throughout much of our church life. Hopkins does not domesticate despair. He found happier moments, and if you'd like to leave in despair, you can go right ahead and eat supper if you like. You're certainly free to go. There's a fourth poem on the sheet that begins to show you that he did come out of this mood. I'd like to read it if anybody wants to stay, but if you have to go, please go now. It's okay.
If you read Cousin Zachas' book, The Last Temptation of Christ, if you're opposed to what we call John's two Gospels, Cousin Zachas takes Christ's life and really kind of feeds it with despair. He battles with everything. That's tremendous.
My own heart let me more have pity on. Let me live to my sad self hereafter kind, charitable. Not live this tormented mind with this tormented mind tormenting yet. I cast for comfort I can no more get by groping round my comfortless than blind eyes in their dark can day, or thirst can find thirsts all in all in world of wet. Soul, self, come poor Jack self, I do advise you, jaded, let be. Call off thoughts a while elsewhere. Leave comfort, root room. Let joy sigh at God knows when to God knows what, whose smiles not wrung, see you, unforeseen times rather, as skies between high mountains lights a lovely mile.
That, I think that as a companion piece to I Wake and Feel the Felt Dark is very nice, because the self-yeast of spirit is contrasted with the realization that casting for comfort in comfortless self gets no joy. I mean, that turning in and brooding only on the comfortlessness
doesn't help. I mean, you can't have my own heart until you have I wake and feel it's all dark. But there's a realization in this one that says you can only do like this thing about how long can the mind, can you stay in those mind mountains that are frightful and sheer and no man fathomed. It's a point at which you have to move out, and I think this is maybe a link poem or something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the images, if you study a sequence of these poems, you'd see the images changing, and there he has certain images that he continues to use, like the mountains. Now we have a lovely mile between pie mountains. And as you were saying, the self is a kind of different self here. It's an everyday workaday self, poor Jack self, rather than the intensity of self that he was trapped with in that dough in the other poem. Roger, were you going to say something?
No.
I thought you were. Okay.
The calling off thoughts a while. The backing out of despair. And I sense it to be saying, you know, how long can you be intense? Mm-hmm. Back off a little bit. Give comfort root room. Let the root go down a little bit. I don't think it's an escapism kind of thing, because you know he'll return to the night and to the blindness and to the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But I sense that in myself sometimes. You get so introspective or so intense on something that at some point you have to laugh a little bit at yourself. Poor Jack self. Lay off. Mm-hmm. Lighten up a little bit.
Or take yourself so
seriously. Yeah, I think that's
what it's like. When he uses the word jaded from the inside instead of the outside, the world battering and beating on you. Sometimes, I believe it's worse when you're doing it yourself, because there is no escape from your mind and yourself. And the words and things you think just bounce off themselves off the walls inside you and never go anywhere and never accomplish anything.
And then at another point you can say, batter me, three-person diet.
You can see John and Herbert in his poems.
Yeah, I think you can see Herbert in his poems a lot.
And age-old Anvil Winston saying.
That was what I was trying to think of last night at dinner. You know, we talked about Herbert last night.
I was trying to think Herbert yesterday when you were reading these, because I knew there was somebody.
Herbert did it.
I mentioned
it. Yeah, he really did.
So they both grapple with that so much, and that's what's neat.
Mm-hmm.
The second stanza is the one that I'm confused with the man. I cast for comfort, I can no more get by groping round my comfortless. Then blind eyes, does he mean other than or more than?
You can no more get it than blind eyes can get it.
You see, now in some ways, I think what he's saying is that for the third line, he says, or thirst can find thirst all in all in a world of wet. In other words, why can we be thirsting in a world in which God has given us all, and it's all there to do is taste it? And so, I wonder if he's not saying that I have gone so, I've gotten so much in my own ego that I can't see your peace, and it's there, and it's like water, Lord, I've got to drink, but I mean, kind of a thing.
You can feel a breaking out of possible egoism, and this egoism in the sense of egocentrism in this poem. And suddenly the sky opens up again at the end.
And the cast, you know, like we were talking yesterday in the poem we were talking about, is this use of natural language and casting actually being a very natural
language. Two things that line reminds me of. One is Douglas John Hall saying that we cannot see light in a world of light, that we have to be led into darkness first before we can see light. And I think that is reminiscent. How can thirst find thirst all in all in a world of wet? It's almost like thirst has to find thirst all in all in a desert. You know, that kind of turning upside down, which makes me think that maybe this isn't only a literal thirst that he's talking about here, but the living water kind of.
Those two things counter each other. Blind eyes in the dark, and they, to me, that really is black and big. Where the other part suggest that all I could do is open her mouth and it will be satisfied, or knock the door to the open type of theology. I don't know. The key word is then.
The parallel things are comfortless, dark, and world of wet.
Well, one of the things that World of Wet suggests there are all his tears that he has shed.
Oh.
Too. His endless devotions and supplications. I like the way that in the last two stanzas, his syntax gets a lot less clotted and gnarled. And it gets clearer and simpler.
Soul self.
Comfort Jackson, yeah.
It is like as if he was talking to somebody.
And as though he's ready to accept a kind of limited peace for a while. It would be a mistake to use this poem, as you were suggesting, I think, Susan, without the other poems. It's just, as soon as someone begins to express some kind of sadness, to say to them, oh, don't take yourself so seriously. You know, there might be good reason for taking yourself seriously for a while. For a long time. So it's not to make a slogan out of Hawkins' poem. It's a long poem and it has many subtle variations in it. And he's not even saying he's not going to be sad anymore, is he? He says, let me live to my sad self hereafter kind. At least I can be kind to my sad self. He's not saying let's clap our hands. Is that what this song says? No hand clapping in this song. Other songs have hand clapping, but not this one.
It's not even going to come, you know, his comfort isn't going to come. He can grow up around his comfortlessness from now until eternity, and he will get no comfort from that. And now somehow he realizes that, you know, it's like he says to himself, yeah, it is going to come, and it will become external.
He uses, go ahead. I don't want to cut you off at all.
This last that we did, the first one today, where I find any suggestion of warmth, and that is only coming from himself being kind. But yesterday, all the ones we went through were warmth and light and hope and brightness and revelation and everything, and drawing other people's attention to everything. He wanted to feel the high beauty and the shining like ship foil, and he's not doing that. That warmth and that suggestion of comfort of the Holy Ghost is maybe coming through a little bit in this poem, but not in any of the other ones we looked at today.
He loves the imagery of homing pigeons and the name and the word home. It's like as though his heart becomes a kind of homing pigeon, coming home to himself, finding himself, finding a comforter in himself. This is an amazing stage for a man to come through who could say, comforter, where is your comfort in? He has found it somehow through himself. And it's not easy, and it's not like some kind of conversion into happiness and optimism again. It's subdued. But it's kind, and the warmth is felt. It's a different kind of warmth than before, like you were saying.
What does it mean, let joy, is it size? God knows when and God knows what.
Yeah.
I think that means grow.
Grow. Let joy grow from those roots. He's putting, you know, give comfort root room and joy, let joy grow. I think he's saying that.
Your smile's not wrong. Does that just mean not put on or not? Not forced,
yeah. Or wrenched out of shape into a frown or a grimace of some kind, because there were sort of images of a God with an ugly face in that other poem. But God smiles not wrung. Maybe he's smiling at me anyway. I think he's saying that. There's another poem that he wrote in 1888, this is 3 years after these dark sonnets that we've been reading, that uses the Jack self idea. Says that there is a little looking back to the violets, isn't there? Violets knee deep. And years later, he wrote to a friend, "It always seemed to me that poetry is unprofessional," meaning not really professional for a priest to be doing. He sincerely believed that sacrificing his poetic gifts was, quote, "a faithful imitation of our Lord in the great sacrifice." Now, the Jesuit order he belonged to did not actively discourage his writing of poetry, but didn't encourage it either. And the Jesuit paper would not publish his verse because it was so difficult and unusual for the Victorian period. They thought that no one would understand it. He himself, I think, discouraged himself more than anything else. He could never be completely firm in his desire to give up his poetry, and he would keep vacillating, and this double-mindedness produced a tension out of which his poetry comes, but it also made him very miserable. In one of his sermons, he works on a common motif of we cannot do two things at once. And he was doing two things at once, trying to be a poet and trying to be a priest. In another letter, he laments what he calls the backward glances I have given with my hand upon the plow. It means the priestly plow. He is worried about the waste of time his poetry requires and the preoccupation of mind that it brings, the disquiet, and particularly the thoughts of vainglory, as he calls it, that have been given rise to by writing poetry. And in these letters, there is a lot of discussion of fame. This is not something we think of anymore, really, very much. We have a very different way of people becoming famous, very shallow way, I think, through simply becoming known through the media. But his ideas about fame are very traditional. He says, he goes back and forth with this. "Fame is a great danger in itself, as dangerous as wealth every bit, I should think, and as hard to enter the kingdom of heaven with." But then he goes on to say, "What I do regret is the loss of recognition belonging to the work itself. The world is full of interesting things and events, phenomena of all sorts, that go without notice, go unwitnessed, like his own poetry, and like the inscapes in nature, the minute and particular things he notices in his nature poems that are also hidden away from the eyes of men." So he was obscure, and he celebrated obscure things. But he needed loving notice, and he wasn't getting it. In another letter by 1886, at the time that the poems we're going to read today, he's working up a very different kind of argument for fame, that is, fame through his poetry. And he says, "I would have all true poets remember that fame, the being known, though in itself one of the most dangerous things to men, is nevertheless the true appointed setting of genius and its works. What are works of art for? To educate, to be standards for the many, for public use. To produce them, then, is of little use, unless what we produce is known. If known widely, the wider known the better. For it is by being known it works, it influences, it does its duty." His poems, to do their duty, and it's his way of kind of reconciling those conflicts, to do good. "We must try to be known, aim at it, take means to it, and this without puffing in the process or pride in the success. Art and its fame do not really matter, spiritual they are nothing, virtue is the only good, but the true rule for dealing with them is what Christ our Lord said of virtue, 'Let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works,' say of art, 'and glorify your Father in heaven.'" If Hopkins' poetry did not shine before men, it was also because his poetry is dark, as he called it, or obscure. It wasn't published in his lifetime. It was only shared with a very small circle of people, not all of whom liked it very much. One of his friends, Coventry Patmore, who was a Victorian poet, called Hopkins' poetry veins of pure gold embedded in masses of impracticable quartz. And you will see the impracticable quartz today, I think, especially. His friend Robert Bridges, as I mentioned the other day, who collected and published Hopkins' poems in 1918, well after Hopkins' death, and had to work very hard to cultivate a public for Hopkins, because he was so avant-garde. He was writing way ahead of his time. And there was no way you could even see a resemblance between some of the poems written at that same time in his own work. But Bridges fills the preface to the first volume of Hopkins' poems with warnings about the poetry's oddities and obscurities, and indeed in many ways it is. There are a couple of reasons for his obscurity. One is that the lines of his poetry are so taut, so packed with words, that you have to unpack them in order to understand them. Doesn't mean you can't be affected by them on first reading, you sure can. But after that, you need to read again and again and kind of ravel them out and maybe even add some of the missing words before you begin to see what he means. It all makes sense, it just takes time to study. He typically tries to inscape, using that word as a verb, inscape the patterns of things, of events, and feelings. For example, here's a description from one of his poems of a tempest on the sea and the losses that it entails. Wiry and white fiery and whirlwind swiveled snow spins to the widow-making, unchilding, unfathering deeps. That's a sentence. Has a subject, a verb, many adjectives. The widow-making, unchilding, unfathering deeps. He also coins words like unchilding and unfathering. He typically puts something in between other words, two words that go together, he inserts something. He doesn't do that to be perverse. He does that to give you the feeling of the thing he's describing. So, for example, he wrote a lot of poems about obscure people, and he has one wonderful poem about a plowman. And he's describing the plowman's long, curly hair that's flying behind him and being plaited by the wind. Hopkins always noticed platings and weavings, whether of sounds or of water, or of hair, or of clouds, or of trees. He was always noticing how things fit together. Anyway, this is what he calls them. He says, "See his wind lily locks laced." Now he's saying his locks, his lily locks, locks that look like lilies, are wind laced, are laced by the wind, right? And instead of saying laced by the wind, which is a pretty ordinary way of saying it, he says, "See his wind lily locks laced." So that the word wind-laced is interrupted by lily-locks, and the effect is of a plating of L sounds. You can almost feel the liquid quality of the hair in the wind. He's always doing that kind of thing. He creates a lot of hyphenated compounds, like John Keats did, and in fact, Hopkins is a romantic poet, a late romantic. And so in one of his poems, he has the phrase, "Dappled dawn drawn falcon." Now, what does that mean? It means a falcon who has been drawn out by the dappled dawn, a dappling in the sky with clouds, perhaps, and colors. And in saying something like that, he's suggesting, I don't know, to me it suggests an image of the dappled dawn, and then a falcon seems to be drawn out by the dawn, and almost getting larger as the picture moves toward you. The dappled dawn drawn falcon, I can see him coming toward me. Anyway. We will struggle with some of these poems ourselves, and you will be on the block in a minute. His earliest appreciators were a handful of poets with whom he corresponded. He once said, "A poet is a public in himself." But he wasn't just a pure individualist. He knew that he needed to have a wider audience, and that he needed to be more intelligible in order to get a broader audience. He felt, too, the need, as anyone would, for a broader audience to cheer him on in his work, because no one was encouraging him. And he called himself, in one of his poems, Time's Eunuch. He said, "I do not breed one work that wakes. His muse sometimes went away." He was, I think, very worn out by his duties as a priest. They wore him out both physically and psychologically. He says in one of his letters, "I take up a languid pen to write to you, being down with diarrhea and vomiting, brought on by yesterday's heat and the long hours in the confessional." Now this is probably from Liverpool. So you can imagine a man extraordinarily sensitive to beauty in that situation might well become sick, physically sick. Liverpool he found a museless place. He says, "One is so fagged, so harried and gallied up and down, and the drunkards go on drinking, and the filthy, as scripture says, are filthy still. Human nature is so inveterate. Would that I had seen the last of it. Now, his darkest time dates from his move to Dublin. He was moved around as a priest would be without his necessarily choosing these places. And when he was in Dublin, he was even farther from home than ever. That was in 1884, where he spent three hard, wearying, wasting, wasted years, as he put it, in Ireland. He was appointed to the chair of Greek at the Royal University. Sounds good, but the Royal University was falling apart, and what the chair of Greek meant was that he had to give six classic examinations a year to 750 candidates and grade all the exams himself meticulously, and he ruined his eyes. A miserable, very unliterary kind of work. He found Ireland heartbreaking. It was racked by convulsions for home rule, for independence. And he wrote about this experience in Ireland and about all his alienations in a poem that's on your sheet. Did anybody get one of these? It's called, "To Seem the Stranger Lies My Lot." Would someone else like to read this while I sort of recover my voice here for a minute? "To Seem the Stranger Lies My Lot." Somebody who's pretty good at reading things. Palm twisters. This isn't really a very difficult poem of his, except that it has one of the most obscure lines in Hoffman's poetry in it, but you will see why it's there. Somebody want to do it?
I'll try.
Okay.
"To seem a stranger lies my lot, my life among strangers. Father and mother dear, brothers and sisters are in Christ not near, and he my peace, my parting, sword and strife. England, whose honor all my heart wars, wife to my creating thought, would neither hear, I suppose that's what he would neither hear me, were I pleading, plead nor do I weary of idle of being, but by where wars are rife. I am at Ireland now, now I am at a third remove, not but in all removes I can kind love both give and get. Only what word, wisest my heart, breeds dark heaven's baffling ban, bars or hell's spell thwarts, this chord unheard, heard unheeded, leaves me a lonely began."
Thank you, that was heroic. Do you know which line I was referring to?
No.
No? They're all, okay. There are several alienations he's talking about in here. The first, and the different stanzas kind of separate them. The first one is from his family and his home. His family were Protestants and thought it was horrible that he became one of these, heretic Catholics. And so, and he himself was worried about their souls. And this is a very religious man, so he was concerned about them. It wasn't just a family feud or something. And so Christ becomes for him his peace, but also his pardon from his family. In the second stanza, he's expressing his alienation from England. He loves England, and he writes wonderful lines about English countryside and about Oxford. And so he missed England too. England, the wife to his creating thought. And he's in a place not of peace, but of war and agitation in Ireland. And then he is also alienated from his poetic muse, and even perhaps from God, and feeling that he can't write poetry, but of course he is writing a poem. I think this is a very good one. What were some of the lines that you'd like to talk about that were hard to get? He deliberately didn't want to write poetry that you could get on first reading. He felt that there was something subtle being said in a subtle way, and you couldn't simply write the obvious in saying that.
What about that "I weary of idle of being"?
Yeah.
That he wasn't producing?
Well, there are a couple words left out. If you would read it differently, "I am weary of being idle only in a place where there are many wars or there is much strife." I think that's what he's saying. That he can't take part in that struggle for freedom. So he feels really out of it. idle being but by. I weary of idle being but by where wars are strife. I think he separates weary to draw out the sound. Are there other lines or phrases that baffled you?
Thwarted? Weary.
What?
How do you spell weary?
W-A-R-Y. Perhaps wear, you know, separate like that emphasizes
being torn or
being
worn out.
Yeah.
I'm weary.
Yeah.
Being tired is being worn out.
Yeah. There's a kind of tiredness from standing by while strife is going on. What about England would neither hear me were I pleading, plead, nor do I? Is that hard to you? Is that hard to understand?
Does it mean England doesn't care about me if I wanted it to care, even if I was begging, and I wouldn't beg.
His would be his fondest wish for his poems to be written and seen not only for the glory of God but for the glory of England. He felt that for an Englishman to write poetry was a credit to England. He said, poem is like a fading bay tree. It's a patriotic duty to write poetry. I mean, he worked up all kinds of arguments for doing it, and that was one of them. I don't know, maybe it's a little hard for Americans to understand that same kind of loyalty to your country with its long tradition and a long religious tradition connected with the culture, too. I am in Ireland now to third remove. It isn't, he says, it isn't just that I can't get kind love or give it. I can. He's not saying that no one is kind to him. It's just that, only that, whatever wisest word my heart breathes, he's using a kind of hen image there, whatever wisest word my heart breathes is barred by dark heaven's baffling ban. It just seems that heaven is keeping him, or God is keeping him from writing his wisest words. Or perhaps, if it's not heaven, it's hell's spell that thwarts me. He's not even sure what it is that is preventing him from being able to write very much poetry. And there's that problem that turns up in his other poems of the discerning of spirits. How do you know whether whatever it is that thwarts you is the will and act of God or something else you should strive against? How do you know that? And being an intensely spiritual man, he really sincerely agonized over those questions. So this, his sort of unhatched eggs of poems, these to hoard unheard by anyone, especially by anyone in his family or anyone in England, to hoard them unheard, or, if heard, unheeded, this situation leaves me a lonely began. Not a beginner, but a began. So why does he say that, do you think? Have you ever felt like a lonely began?
He made the effort and he started as if to move someplace with the thought, or to carry the reader to change their mind and carry them along with him only, or the reader or himself, whatever it is he's seeking to free by his writing, but it's not working. So it's just, it leaves him his attempts, his beginnings over and over.
Yeah. It's kind of like saying he's a has-been or could be, but it emphasizes the notion of being, too. It's like an unfinished being. He relishes in his earlier, more happy poetry, completeness. He feels incomplete, unfinished. In that sense, very romantic, I think. He could not get on with his writing in Dublin, and in one of his letters he breaks out, all in capital letters, so poignantly, and he says, "And what does anything at all matter?" In many of the letters, there are complaints of nervous prostration. He says they should see my heart and vitals, all shaggy with the whitest hair. And in another letter, around the time of the sonnets we're going to read next, he diagnoses his own case. He says, I think my fits of sadness, though they do not affect my judgment, must resemble madness. Now, Hopkins was beginning to write, even in 1883, a very different kind of poetry than he had written before. A kind of poetry in which he saw the inscapes of the world, but then saw them falling apart. And if you know Yeats' poem, Sailing to Byzantium, things fall apart, the center does not hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. He begins to feel that sense of the inscapes falling apart. In his earlier poetry, this idea kind of pulls things together for him, but now they begin to fall apart. And that the poem, Sybil's Leaves, which I haven't put on your sheet, is a poem that is about the dismembering of inscapes. I might read this. Let's see. First, you can feel this whole poem winding down. And there's a lot of celebratory imagery in the first part, here and there. But by the end of the poem, he has abandoned all the richness that he's celebrated before, and that his colors become black and white. And he turns his attention, and I'm reading this because this is typical of the movement of his poetry, toward the poems we're going to read. He turns his attention away from nature, the sky, the sunsets, and so on, into himself. Okay. Now some of this won't make sense, but just feel it. That's all we'll do with this one. Earnest, earthless, equal, attunable, vaulty, voluminous, stupendous, evening strains to be time's vast, womb of all, home of all, hearse of all, night. Her fond yellow horn light wound to the west, her wild hollow hoar light hung to the height waste. Her earliest stars, earl stars, stars principal overbend us, fire featuring heaven. For earth, her being has unbound. Her dapple is at an end, astray or a swarm, all through there in throngs, self in self steeped and pashed, quite disremembering, dismembering all now. Heart, you round me right with, our evening is over us, our night whelms, whelms, and will end us. Only the beak-leaved boughs, dragonish, damask the tool-smooth, bleak, light, black, ever so black on it, our tale, oh, our oracle. Let life waned, ah, let life wind off her once skeined, stained, veined variety upon all on two spools, part, pen, pack, now her all in two flocks, two folds, black, white, right, wrong, reckon but, wreck but, mind but these two, where of a world where but these two tell, each off the other, of a rack, where, self-wrung, self-strung, sheath and shelterless, thoughts against thoughts in groans grind. Does that make any sense at all? It's an amazing poem. It's an amazing poem. But the movement of his mind,
yeah,
from voluminous to thoughts against thoughts in groans grind.
Well, even his words, they seem to break down. Communication isn't as complete. He leaves much more to your intuition at the end of it. And it seems like there he uses a device that I haven't heard in as much of his other stuff, where he would say a phrase and then shorten both the words, like you said, early star and then earl star and then reckoned but and reck but, and just keep shortening down things as if repeating them, but taking out part of them,
yeah. He even does that with the language, suggesting a kind of shrinking back. And behind this, to some extent, he says wreck nothing but black and white, right and wrong. He's kind of suggesting that this wonderful veined variety of the world is dangerous to the moral man, and he has to reject it, turn everything into moral simplicities. And yet, that's not all he's saying. There's a dialogue of the mind and itself going on in here, which turns into the poems we're going to read now. He produced, through this terribly difficult period, finally, two sonnets that he said were written in blood. This was in 1885. His dark sonnets seem wrenched from deep distress, and they seem to be about separation from God, but also terrible encounters with God, not as a benign force or a beauty-making power, but as a monster, as a devouring monster. And yet, these are poems. They're beautiful poems that he's able to write. Beautiful but horrible at the same time. Let's see, which one of these shall we look at first? Maybe we'll look at No Worst. And now, you'll hear in here, I think, first an image of childbirth, a terrifying image of childbirth, and then he moves on to a series of other images. No worst, there is none. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is our relief? My cries heave, herds long, huddle in amain, a chief woe, world sorrow. On an age-old anvil wince and sing, then law, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, let me be fell, force I must be brief. Oh, the mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap may who ne'er hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort, serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end. And what kind of impact does this poem have on you? Do you read it for the first time? Maybe the first time. There's nothing. He just has to give up and go to sleep or something. It's nothing. Now, they don't all end that way, but this is maybe the most despairing of them all. He had a lot of reasons for his grief. Worn out by the spiritual discipline of the order, worn out by his work, his physical condition, his mental condition, his isolation, his fear that his poetry would never communicate, and it was so important to him that it would communicate. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. It just seems that every cry of pain produces more cries of pain. There are lots of things in his earlier poems about the paraclete, the comforter, the dove coming to comfort, and here it's just, comforter, where is your comfort? There are lines in his poem that are real plain like that.
This is sort of the Calvary of his poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, this is his My God, Why Have You Abandoned Me kind of poem. Yeah.
You see that in the first two stanzas, if you want to call it that, but then in the couplet, I see, I don't read it the same way you do.
Okay.
Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. In other words, it'll soon be over. The way I read it. Here, creep, wretch. He sees himself as a belittled human being. Under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end. And each day dies in sleep. Mm-hmm. So though the day be black and dead, it dies in sleep, and in the morning there will be hope.
Yeah.
So I don't see it quite as, I mean, yeah, it's gloomy. Yeah. But the couplet to me serves as more than a calvary, it serves as a resurrection.
I guess I don't see the resurrection of the couplet, only that, you know, death, you know, death will end this. You know, nothing is preferable to this. And that's what death, the night will bring us nothing.
I think the only thing that would offer us hope in here, even though maybe we would project it in there because that's what we would think about, but the fact that he said each day dies with sleep, and as we know sleep, we wake every morning. If he had said death or something else that we thought of as a terminal state of being, there wouldn't be any hope. But since he says sleep, automatically, I think without thinking about it, we subconsciously know that we do wake from sleep at some point, which is really reaching, but that is the only way you could find hope in
Except it seems like then you just start the birth pangs all over again. And Mary has no relief. She never gives birth. She's always in labor. And this idea about the durance, you know, it seems to me it's like the reason sleep and death come is because we can't be that intense for too long. We can't be hanging on to the sheer cliffs of the mountains in our minds for too long. Sleep and death just give us a relief from it. But I think mourning would just bring more pangs and no birth.